I'm Stephen Dubner, and this is Freakonomics Radio. If you are new to the show, you might assume from its name that we deal with straight-ahead economics, employment, cost of living, things like that. But if you've been listening for a while, you know we don't do that much straight-ahead economics. We tend to favor stories like the economics of sleep.
We find that permanently increasing sleep by an hour per week increases wages by about 4.5%.
We do stories about the significance of the lowly pencil.
You realize there isn't a single person in the world who would really understand how to make a pencil from scratch.
We even made a show about the unlikely triumph of the belt.
If he was a very rotund gentleman, he might have made suspenders popular instead of belts.
But this week's show does deal with a straight-ahead economic issue. It's about an idea whose time finally may have come, an idea that may present a solution to two separate problems. The first problem is that a lot of full-time jobs in the modern economy simply don't pay a living wage. Second problem is that even a lot of those jobs may not be around for long. Eric Brynjolfsson is an MIT professor who deals with the economics of technology.
We're now beginning to have machines be able to augment and automate our brains and replace mental tasks. Machines can do computations and make decisions. And we're still in the early stages of this, but we believe that the implications will be at least as profound as what the Industrial Revolution did for our muscles.
In a book he co-authored with Andrew McAfee, Brynjolfsson calls this technological disruption the second machine age. Yes, it will likely produce gains in living standards, but it also might lead to a massive evaporation of jobs. Emphasis on the might. This can be aggressively argued in either direction.
There are folks who are confident that the technology is going to lead to a bounty for all and make everyone better off. And there are other people who are very concerned that we'll have a jobless future and a lot of people will be left in poverty.
Take just one example. Driverless cars, a technology I'm sure you've heard something about. It is not hard to believe that in 10 or 30 or 50 years, many of our vehicles will drive themselves. So what happens to all the people who drive for a living? All those taxis and Uber cars and ambulances and heavy trucks? In the U.S. alone, that's roughly 3.5 million people. Sure, some jobs will be created by driverless technology, but what are all those drivers supposed to do when their livelihood is obliterated?
There'll be winners and losers. Already we're seeing that some kinds of tasks and skills are much less valuable, and people with those tasks and skills have seen their wages fall, and so it hasn't been a rising tide that lifted all boats.
So if there's a massive evaporation of jobs, and if too many hardworking people continue to earn too little to live on, what happens next? Could one solution to both problems be an idea that's been floating around in economic circles for decades? Here's the idea. What if everyone automatically received from the government a guaranteed basic income? That's our question of the day on Freakonomics Radio. Would it work? Can governments afford it? And what would happen if the financial incentive to work goes away?
Sure, maybe 90% of people will go smoke pot and play video games. But if 10% of the people go create incredible new products and services and new wealth, that's still a huge net win.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
A guaranteed or universal or unconditional basic income is an idea that economists have toyed with for years. There are, of course, many forms of government welfare around the world, but universal payouts are rare. The Alaskan government, for instance, has since 1982 paid a dividend on oil revenues to all residents, about $1,100 a year on average. Not exactly enough to live on, but several governments are looking at more substantial payments. In some cases, everyone would get a payout, rich or poor, employed or not. In others, only low-income people would benefit. Switzerland is planning a referendum, which probably won't pass, to be honest. that would pay every adult around $2,600 US a month and every child around $650. How about in the US? The idea has not gotten much traction in Washington, although Bernie Sanders has expressed his sympathy for it. Perhaps not too surprising for a self-declared socialist. But that's the thing about the guaranteed income idea. You can see why a socialist or just about anyone on the left might like it, theoretically at least. It's a permanent financial safety net. But conservatives should also like it, again, at least theoretically, because it's a way to shrink the welfare state by folding up a bunch of Byzantine entitlement programs into one tidy check. Now, what would a guaranteed income program actually look like? Where would the money come from? And if you give everyone in America a check for something like $20,000 every year, wouldn't inflation render the poor people just as poor as before? These questions are all really, really hard to answer, but we can probably learn at least a little bit by going back in time. In the late 18th century, founding father Thomas Paine argued for a substantial universal payout based on our collective share of the Earth's natural resources. It didn't happen. In the 1940s, the economists George Stigler and Milton Friedman helped put another version into play. It was called a negative income tax. It was meant to support people in grave need. Here's the economist Evelyn Forget.
So the idea was that if you had no income from any other source, you'd receive a certain level of income, a sort of socially agreed upon level.
Forget is an economist at the University of Manitoba.
And as your income from other sources, and in particular from the labor market, increased, your benefit would decline, but it would decline less than proportionately.
And here is Milton Friedman, in his usual direct style, explaining what he saw as the benefits of the idea.
The proposal for a negative income tax is a proposal to help poor people by giving them money, which is what they need, rather than as now, by requiring them to come before a governmental official, detail all their assets and their liabilities, and be told that you may spend X dollars on rent, Y dollars on food, etc., and then be given a handout.
The hope was that a negative income tax would streamline the burgeoning welfare system without diluting the incentive to work as much as the existing system did.
Our present welfare programs, our present direct relief, and aid to dependent children programs, in effect, have a 100% tax rate. Because if a family on relief, if let's say a woman, as currently is mostly the case under aid to dependent children, if a woman who is on relief takes a job and earns $100, and she's honest, she is required to have her relief payment reduced by $100. That's one of the ways in which we've been producing poor people.
More than 1,000 economists from 125 American universities signed a statement supporting a national system of income guarantees and supplements. The idea had support from many quarters, like the staunch libertarian Friedrich Hayek.
I have no objection against a flat minimum secured to everybody who cannot earn enough in the market.
To civil rights leader Martin Luther King.
That is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
In 1968, the Republican president-elect Richard Nixon appointed as his urban affairs counselor Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the liberal sociologist and future Democratic senator who was intensely focused on race and poverty. They created what came to be called the Family Assistance Plan.
What I am proposing is that the federal government build a foundation under the income of every American family with dependent children that cannot care for itself, and wherever in America that family may live.
The Family Assistance Plan was sent to Congress. If it got through, it wouldn't be a guaranteed universal income, but rather a floor under incomes for poor families. Nixon was very, very careful to draw this distinction.
This national floor under incomes for working or dependent families is not a guaranteed income. Under the guaranteed income proposal, everyone would be assured a minimum income, regardless of how much he was capable of earning, regardless of what his need was, regardless of whether or not he was willing to work. A guaranteed income would undermine the incentive to work. The family assistance plan that I propose increases the incentive to work.
But was this balance possible? To find out, the federal government had begun a series of experiments.
The purpose of all of these experiments was to look at the labor market outcomes.
Evelyn Forget again.
The big concern everybody had at the time was, you know, if you give people money for nothing, why won't they just quit their jobs?
Starting in 1968, the federal government ran a series of four negative tax experiments in different parts of the country with different demographics. Low-income urban couples, rural families, black households, especially those headed by single women. Selection was randomized, which meant there was always a control group. This is thought to be the first time the U.S. government used this kind of experimentation to measure the effects of a policy idea. Granted, it would be many years before they'd have the data, and Nixon's family assistance plan was still making its way through the political channels. Soon, a similar experiment was happening in Canada.
I was sitting in a first-year economics class at Glendon College in Toronto, and my professor came in and started to talk about this wonderful experiment that he said was being conducted way out west somewhere, and it was going to revolutionize the way we delivered social programs.
Evelyn Forget points out that the U.S. movement had a conservative thrust, with Milton Friedman advocating for smaller government. But Canada was different.
In Canada, the support tended to come from the left. It was a sort of social democratic impulse, and most of the rhetoric was in terms of social justice.
It was called a MINCOM experiment, as in minimum income. It was conducted in just a couple places, including a town of about 12,000 called Dauphin. It's in Manitoba, a few hours northwest of Winnipeg.
Dauphin was a small town like a lot of other small towns in Canada. It was very dependent on agriculture. There was nothing unique about it, and that's what made it such an interesting saturation site.
A saturation site, meaning that every person who met the income eligibility was offered the deal. In Dauphin, that meant about 30% of the town.
If your income falls below a certain level, you'll receive so much. And as your income increases, your benefit will be reduced. The nice thing about the guaranteed annual income, because people get to keep a portion of their benefits as they go out to work, is that this becomes a supplement for the working poor as well, and there's an encouragement to work.
So in the mid to late 1970s, if you were unlucky enough to be poor but lucky enough to live in Dauphin, Manitoba, you would be eligible for a check from the government. Forget says that a family of four would get the equivalent of roughly 15,000 current U.S. dollars a year. This was in lieu of any existing welfare benefits.
And it wasn't enough to give people a comfortable life. When we interviewed a number of the participants, one of the participants had this lovely line that it was enough to add some cream to the coffee.
That said, the Canadian government spent millions of dollars on the project, but for a good cause, right? To find out if it could support its low-income citizens without killing the incentive to work. So, did the MINCOM experiment work well enough to be turned into policy? What did the data show?
No one ever wrote a final report. There was no more money forthcoming to do an evaluation of the project, and it just disappeared.
Uh-oh. Between an economic downturn and political upheaval, the Canadian MINCOM project lost its mojo.
The researchers were told to archive the data for future research. And effectively what they did was to empty the file cabinets and put all the paper into cardboard boxes.
Back in the States, things weren't going much better. The Nixon-Moynihan Family Assistance Plan had died in Congress. The right thought it was too expensive. The left thought it wasn't generous enough. Ultimately, however, there were at least two direct legacies of the plan which are still around today. Supplemental security income, which increased federal support for the elderly, blind, and disabled. And the earned income tax credit, which is a small negative income tax, although not a guaranteed income. By now, the political momentum for some kind of universal guaranteed income had greatly diminished, no matter what the data might have to say about whether such a thing could actually work. But what did the data say? The American experiments were still ongoing, and the final analysis was still way down the road. In Canada, remember, the data had been packed up in cardboard boxes.
I finally did track it down.
That's Evelyn Forget again. It took a while, but she found the boxes of data.
I found 1,800 of them in a warehouse in Winnipeg under the authority of the National Archives. But, I mean, I was literally looking at 1,800 boxes full of really badly organized data. No one had ever constructed a database, and no analysis had been done.
She thought about going through the boxes and building a database.
And I sort of realized that my life was finite, and I wasn't going to be able to do anything with that particular data.
But thinking about the Mincom experiment in Dauphin did give Forget an idea.
One of the defining features of this period in Canada was that this was the period when universal health insurance was introduced. And one of the unanticipated consequences of universal health insurance is that you collect quite a lot of data on individuals.
And those data had been sorted and digitized, data on education, employment, and of course, health. So what if Forget could look in these data for people who lived in Dauphin and who presumably got that extra government money and then compare them to other low-income people in other towns who didn't get that Mincom boost?
And I was able to find everybody who was living in Dauphin during that particular period. So the first thing I did was to look at hospitalization rates. And I found that hospitalization rates had fallen by about 8.5% for the test group in Dauphin relative to the match control group.
Okay, so it looked like the Mincom recipients were healthier. What else did Forget find in the data?
One of the findings was that high school completion rates had increased. And we discovered fairly quickly that boys in particular in low-income families had been under a fair amount of pressure to become self-supporting as quickly as they could. When Mincom came along, some of the families decided that they could allow their sons to stay in high school just a little bit longer. So instead of quitting school at age 16 and getting their first full-time job, these boys stayed in school until they were 18, until they'd graduated from high school, and took their first full-time job a little bit later.
So in the raw data, it might look like employment fell since a bunch of 16 and 17-year-old boys were not joining the workforce. But in fact, this was good news since they were staying in school, presumably setting themselves up for a better work life. But what about employment among grown-ups? That's the big concern of any guaranteed income plan. Did they stop working once they started getting a government check?
Grown-up people with full-time jobs don't actually reduce the number of hours they work by very much.
One exception, women, especially those who wanted more time off after having a baby.
At the time, I think the legal entitlement was 4 weeks. And it's sort of interesting because as a society, we've already decided that longer parental leaves are something that we want to support. So they effectively anticipated that policy change.
So the effects of the Canadian Mincom experiment seem to be pretty positive. Now, keep in mind, the dollars to do this have to come from somewhere, new taxes or cuts in entitlements or other services. That, of course, is going to be a major part of any discussion about any guaranteed income plan. But the data seemed to show that the biggest concern that everyone would just quit their jobs did not happen, at least in the Canadian experiment. Now, what about the U.S. experiments?
In general, the finding was that primary earners really don't reduce the number of hours they work very much when you offer a guaranteed annual income. It's secondary earners and tertiary earners, that is, second adult incomes and the incomes of adolescents, that fall a little bit.
Very similar to the Canadian results. So there, too, the news was pretty good, although there was something troubling in the U.S. data.
When the findings started to come in, it looked like the families that were receiving a guaranteed annual income might, in fact, have a higher divorce rate. And this became very political very quickly in the U.S. There were all kinds of concerns that this was an attack on the American family.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a champion of the guaranteed income idea, was also a champion of the nuclear family. The divorce findings led him to withdraw his support. But Evelyn Forget says that when the data were examined more carefully over time, the divorce controversy seems to have been overblown.
There was a subsequent work about a decade later which suggested that it might have been a statistical anomaly.
So the evidence from these experiments, as narrow as it may be, seems to suggest that a guaranteed income can produce positive results. The funding and the politics are, of course, separate and large questions. But one reason the idea has gained momentum lately is that the world has changed a lot since those experiments. Our economies have changed a lot. There's already been wage stagnation. Technological disruption keeps on coming. All of which makes at least one economist, Evelyn Forget, think that the timing is right.
I do see a fundamental and ongoing change in the way the labor market operates, and I do think that we need to make some fundamental changes in the way we deliver social programs. I think a guaranteed annual income could do a very nice job of addressing some of these issues.
But coming up on Freakonomics Radio, politics being what they are, especially the inter-party hostilities of American politics, who is best positioned to figure out how to actually create a successful and affordable guaranteed income program?
Today it costs, I don't know, $30,000 or $40,000 a year to have a really great life in a big city in the U.S., minimum. What can we do to make that number a lot lower? How can we have technology continue to drive that number down?
And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can also find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
For many people, wages have stagnated. For many others, their jobs may be disappearing entirely. What's to be done so that financially vulnerable people aren't just crushed? One of the most radical proposals is for a guaranteed basic income. While several governments are starting to experiment with this idea, economists are not universal in their support. Here's Robert Gordon, author of The Rise and Fall of American Growth.
As far as a guaranteed minimum income, I'm not in favor of that. I'm in favor of a modest increase in the minimum wage and a substantial increase in the earned income tax credit, which encourages low-income people to work.
Why would you not be in favor of the minimum guaranteed income?
There's too much of an incentive if you guarantee income to replace work. And if you provide a guaranteed minimum income to everybody, then those with low skills will drop out of the labor force and will no longer work. So I think it's a matter of incentives. A guaranteed minimum income would put a very high implicit marginal tax rate on going to work for those with relatively low skills.
Is Robert Gordon right? Are boosting the minimum wage and the earned income tax credit better solutions than a universal basic income? Or what about wage insurance, where the government supplements the income of people whose jobs just don't pay enough to live on? Again, these questions are nearly impossible to answer right now. There are the metaphysical questions as well.
Does basic income make people happy and fulfilled? Does it make them less stressed? Does it make them do better long-term planning?
That's Sam Altman. He is the president of Y Combinator in Mountain View, California.
Y Combinator is a company that funds startups.
Meaning a venture capital firm. For instance,
we've invested in Airbnb, Dropbox, Stripe, Zenefits, Instacart, Reddit. We've invested in about 1,100 companies in total.
But also,
more recently, we also have started funding basic research.
To that end, Y Combinator is launching an in-house research project on a guaranteed basic income.
The tentative plan is to hire a social science researcher and to have him or her pick a group of people and give some of them some amount of money, maybe different amounts of money for 5 years, and observe what happens relative to a control group.
The research would also try to figure ways to drive down the baseline cost of living.
You know, today, say maybe it costs, I don't know, $30,000 or $40,000 a year to have a really great life in a big city in the U.S., minimum. What can we do to make that number a lot lower? How can we have technology continue to drive that number down?
The biggest problem, Altman says, is housing.
And that is the hardest thing to fix with technology. It's the most dependent on policy. Other than housing, I think we can make great progress just with technology. If you think about a world where We get nuclear fusion to work. We make continued progress on agricultural technology and water technology and transportation. Or we, you know, use technology to really make education a lot more efficient. You could easily see the costs of the baseline come down a huge amount. And I think if you're not a kind of a crazy techno-optimist, which I'd say I am, you underweight that.
Being a techno-optimist in Silicon Valley is why Altman started thinking about a basic income.
I think there is a sense that technological job destruction is accelerating more than people outside of Silicon Valley realize. And I think this is mostly narrow applications of AI, but it's going to happen for lots of other reasons. And so I think people in Silicon Valley are saying, man, there are going to be incredible changes in the next few decades. What can we do to make that as smooth as possible? I do think that as we as a society get richer and richer, there should be some sort of floor for everybody. And in a way, basic income is sort of the libertarian approach to doing this, right? It's actually healthy for a society if some people get incredibly rich. But there should be a floor below which we as a society don't allow people to fall.
In Altman's view, the idea of a basic income isn't counterintuitive at all, even in a capitalist framework. He sees it as perfectly intuitive.
I think the default belief of a child is that everyone should get food to eat and a place to sleep, and it strikes most children as incredibly unfair that that's not the case. In fact, I think that's so universal that is somehow probably encoded into our genes, this idea of fairness and equality. And I think people then get older and move away from it.
Every conversation you have with anyone about the idea of a basic income inevitably comes around to one point, the value of work. Not just the financial payoff, but what you might call the moral payoff. That if anyone who wanted to could get a basic income without working, that it might destroy our moral fiber, our social fiber. Here's the MIT economist Eric Brynjolfsson again.
People get a lot of meaning from participating and contributing to society. And the way we're set up right now, if we just got rid of the jobs and replaced it with a check, I think a lot of people would be unhappy.
Sam Altman isn't so sure.
Maybe 90% of people will go smoke pot and play video games. But if 10% of the people go create incredible new products and services and new wealth, that's still a huge net win. And the kind of American puritanical ideal that hard work for its own sake is valuable, period, and you can't question that, I think that's just wrong.
Well, I think that there are lots of kinds of work.
And that, again, is the economist Evelyn Forget.
I think people do need to create meaning in their lives. And for a lot of people, that does come through work. I'm not sure that they necessarily need 8 hours of work a day and 40 hours of work a week to find that meaning.
Forget, like Sam Altman, sees a potentially huge upside in freeing people of the need to work.
If you look at the 18th and at the 19th century, some of the great scientific breakthroughs and some of the great cultural breakthroughs were made by people who did not work. These were gentlemen of leisure. Right? These were people who had enough family money to support themselves. They certainly didn't have to dirty their hands doing the kinds of work we take for granted. I don't think these individuals felt useless. I don't think their contribution was negligible. I think it was very important to the development of the world.
That may all be true, but if for whatever reasons we all start working a lot less, whether or not there's a guaranteed income involved, humankind is in for a big change. For most of civilization, work has been a huge part of what it means to be human. So, what happens if the techno-optimist dream comes true? What happens if computers and robots can take care of most or all of our work? Will our robot overlords even want us around anymore? Or will we just be in their way? Sure, it's a troubling thought, but consider one example, which may seem way off base at first, but consider another population that used to have to work for a living. The relationship between dogs and humans goes way back.
We know that dogs were not just the first domesticated animal, the first domesticated anything.
That's Gregor Larson.
I'm at the University of Oxford in the Department of Archaeology, and for the purposes of this, I'm studying the origins and evolution of dogs.
The domestication process was long and complicated.
So what we think may have happened is that a pack of wolves, rather than following, say, caribou or going after megafauna or something else, started following us instead, because the wolves could make a living simply by living off of the back end of us. And in doing so, they would put a selection pressure on themselves to become more acclimated to us.
More acclimated and, over time, more useful. Let's say you are hunting and you just nick your prey.
If you have a dog with you and whatever you've just nicked is leaving a blood trail, that dog will be able to sniff out that injured animal and then locate it. And so all you have to do is follow it.
Over time, dogs did all kinds of work for us. They herded cattle. They guarded our property. They even helped cook our food. Seriously, a breed called the turnspit dog had a long body, short legs, and it would run in a wheel that turned a spit over a fire to make sure the meat cooked evenly.
These dogs were bred, or at least the best ones were just able to sit in these wheels, and that's all they did all day, is just run and run and run and run.
Eventually, technology put the turnspit dog out of a job, just as technology may eventually put a lot of people out of jobs. A lot of dog work was replaced with machinery or other technology. Like people, some of them found new and different work as guide dogs, as therapy dogs. Dogs were trained to sniff out drugs or explosives, even illness in a human. Here at Freakonomics Radio, we've given one particularly clever pack of dogs some very specific training. But let's face it, most dogs aren't that clever. So, when their jobs began to disappear, they didn't find new work. So did dogs just vanish? No, they did not. In fact, they flourished. When we no longer needed them as workmates, we turned them into pets. In the U.S. alone, about 54 million households own a dog, easily the most common pet. Cats are second. In about 43 million households, freshwater fish a distant third in 12 million. Our spending on pets has tripled in just the past two decades to more than $60 billion a year. Dogs went from being on the production side of the human equation to the consumption side, big time. So, who's to say that we, their masters, won't find a way to make peace with our robotic masters even when we no longer have any work to do? Personally, I think I would make a great pet for anyone willing to adopt me. Anyone interested? Serious inquiries only, please, to radio@freakonomics.com.
There are exotic pets breaking free, running wild through the trees of the city park tonight.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, another story about giving people a big bucket of cash, but in a very different way, in a very different time and place. It was a land lottery in Georgia in 1832. What happened to the people who won this windfall? Did their wealth grow and grow over the generations?
I was surprised. I would not have expected this at all.
And what do we know about contemporary lottery winners?
If you want to be depressed, you should read either the academic literature or, you know, the journalistic accounts of lottery winners, because they basically waste it, right? Or blow through the money very quickly and oftentimes end up worse than how they started, many of them.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Not long ago, we heard from a Freakonomics Radio listener named Thomas Appleton. He'd been talking with a friend about giving money to charity, and he had this idea.
I was wondering, what would be the socioeconomic effect if the 50 wealthiest Americans each selected 50 needy American families and gave each one a one-time gift of $50,000 and repeated the process every year with new beneficiaries. And what if these efforts were concentrated in, for instance, like some of the poorest neighborhoods in Brooklyn?
So that's an interesting question. In economic terms, Thomas is asking about the effects of a geographically concentrated, one-time, unconditional cash transfer, and whether, for instance, it will lead to real intergenerational income mobility. Although the way he puts it, I admit, is much more exciting. Giving away $50,000 may sound like a lot of money, but if it means helping not only this one family, but the next generation and the next, it's probably a bargain, right? One way to answer this question would be to run a big experiment, meaning we'd need to randomize who gets the money, which also means having a control group so we can measure the effect of the money. And also, we need a lot of time. Even if we could give $50,000 to 50 families today, we'd want to see the long-term effect of that money, right? How it affects their children and their grandchildren. So wouldn't it be great if somewhere in history, something like this already happened? That there was some magical data set that a couple of scholars could analyze and write a paper that answers these questions?
The paper is Shocking Behavior, Random Wealth in Antebellum Georgia, and Human Capital Across Generations.
Well, hello. That is Hoyt Blakely. He teaches economics at the University of Michigan. He did this research with Joseph Ferry, an economist at Northwestern. So the shocking behavior that we're talking about is a shock to the system, which is this land lottery that happened in Georgia in the early 19th century, yes?
That's right. So there's sort of a little-known fun fact from antebellum days, which is the state of Georgia opened up almost three-quarters of its territory to white settlers through a system of lotteries, as in actually pulling names out of a barrel to randomly give out land rights.
Now, this land, we should say, had been confiscated from the Indians, right?
That's correct. So that's the less fun part of the fact, which is that, of course, this happened because of the displacement of the Cherokee and the Creek. And in fact, you know, this particular episode we look at is what gave rise to what's called the Trail of Tears, where the Cherokee were force-marched to Oklahoma under some depraved circumstances.
Okay, so the government of Georgia had a lot of land, and they used to give land away in a different way, right? A less random way?
That's quite a lot less random. Yeah, something that looks a lot more similar to the way it had been done for much of the east of the U.S., which is to say they would issue grants or they would have people go out and claim land, and they would be entitled to a certain claim, but they would also have to show evidence that they'd done something with it.
Okay. And why did this lottery come about? What precipitated the need?
Well, so take yourself back to that map that you may have seen in 11th grade in high school history,
Okay. Where
the colonies, you know, the new states were claiming land all the way out to the Mississippi. There's, you know, you might have seen this thing where there's like a super elongated map of New York and Georgia and Virginia all claiming out to the Mississippi. And so some enterprising set of gentlemen decided they were going to start selling that land that Georgia was claiming, opening up for settlement. And the way they did this is they basically bribed a majority of the legislators in Georgia to make this happen. This generated such a scandal because in part it wasn't clear Georgia actually had title to this land, because, you know, was legally able to give out the land. Eventually they gave it up. This land was in the state of Mississippi eventually. But further, it generated such a throw the rascals out movement that when they came around to allocating the part of the state that really was part of Georgia, politicians opted for what they viewed as the most incorruptible, the most transparent mechanism possible. And they came upon the lottery as such an idea. And so they went and, you know, surveyed the land into a bunch of parcels, set out a grid. And after that time, they started pulling names out of barrels. And essentially every white male who had lived in Georgia for a few years was eligible to participate. And there was so much money on the table from participating, right? It cost you 12 cents to register. And
could you buy more than one ticket, or everybody could have just one?
No, this was – don't think of this as go to the store and buy
it's
a ticket.
Powerball.
It was simply
yeah.
No. So you're basically eligible for one registration, and we estimate approximately 100% of the people registered.
Okay. So tell me just a couple quick facts about this. What share of, you said that there was virtually 100% participation because it was pretty much free to sign up to try to win some land. What share of people then won? What were my chances of winning?
Yeah, it was a little shy of 20% of the people won.
And then how much land are they winning? And I want to know what that land is worth. And I also want to know how I can convert that land into value. In other words, can I sell it right away or do I have to actually go and farm or build something on it?
Sure. So in the particular one we analyzed, they were winning 160-acre parcels in the northwest part of Georgia. So think Atlanta and to the northwest of that. We estimate that they were winning numbers in the hundreds of dollars, maybe $500 to $800 by if you value this in 1850 units, which is when we observe them.
And let's put that in constant dollars then. It's worth roughly what today?
Well, it's worth a lot. It's worth a lot in the sense – it's a little bit hard to convert that into a number today because prices are so different. So let me just give you two ways of thinking about that. One is that's pretty close to the median level of wealth. You know, think about a bell curve of wealth. We're basically taking, you know, some amount of money that's approximately equal to where, you know, half the people are above and below that, right, of the non-winners.
Okay. So in other words, if I am essentially penniless, but I happen to be a white male living in Georgia for a few years and therefore I'm entitled to enter this lottery, I can overnight have the same amount of wealth that is the median wealth in Georgia.
That's right.
So it's for certain people then, it will be a life-changing event. Not for all, but for some, yes?
It should be, yes, that's right.
Okay, so it's 1832, and the state of Georgia is giving away a bunch of land via a lottery. Roughly 1 in 5 people who enter the lottery will win. Economically speaking, it's a pretty substantial windfall, and for a pair of 21st century researchers, it's a pretty big windfall too. This kind of organic randomization, it's what economists call a natural experiment. It doesn't happen every day.
I was walking past the Georgia section at the University of Chicago library at some point and see this title that says the Cherokee Land Lottery. Big, thick book. Walking past it. You know how this is. Your brain takes a second to tell your legs to stop moving. And so I finally, a couple stacks down, I turn around and think, I got to go look at this book. And I pull the book out and there's a series of these books about the lotteries that describe the participants, names, you know, actual winners, what they won, that sort of thing. And at that point, you know, I was stunned. I thought, can this really be that they randomized wealth? And I got on the horn with Joseph Ferry, who's my co-author at Northwestern University. He's spent a lot of his career tracking people through these historical records. And I said, you know, we got to follow up on these people because this was potentially a life-changing event for them.
So I guess if I were to guess what you're thinking then, I would guess that you're going to say, well, okay, so here's a perfect tool to tease out the question of, do people whose children and grandchildren do better than them do so because of money and because they use money in a certain way? Or are there other explanations for it? Is that what you were concerned and excited about?
That's exactly right.
So this pair of economists, Hoyt Blakely and Joseph Ferry, found a fascinating data set from a fascinating moment in history, a big land lottery in Georgia in 1832. They realized they could use these data, along with U.S. Census data, to follow families over time, comparing lottery winners to losers, to see how this shock of sudden wealth affected those families. Did the kids in these families acquire more human capital, as economists call it? Did they get more education? And did they parlay that education into even more wealth a generation or two down the road?
We see a really huge change in the wealth of the individuals, but we don't see any difference in human capital. We don't see that the children are going to school more. If your father won the lottery or he lost the lottery, the school attendance rates are pretty much the same. The literacy rates are pretty much the same. As we follow those sons into adulthood, their wealth looks the same, you know, in a statistical sense, whether their father won the lottery, lost the lottery. Their occupation looks the same. The grandchildren aren't going to school more. The grandchildren aren't more literate.
Wow. All right. So two questions for you. One, were you surprised?
I was surprised. I would not have expected this at all.
It's worth noting that these results don't exactly jibe with what we heard about earlier in the Canadian Mincome experiment, where a guaranteed basic income seemed to have led some teenage boys to stay in school longer. The fact is, the literature on what is called unconditional cash transfers, that is, giving money with no strings attached, shows mixed evidence, which is why you have to try to drill into the particulars whenever you can. So my next question then would be, where does this money go? You're saying that the next generation doesn't maintain the wealth. What happens to this wealth then? Is it just dissipated?
Where did it go? Well, you know, this is a period where, you know, you didn't necessarily have access to good retirement assets apart from the stuff that you owned right around you. You could imagine that the families that won used this for themselves, right, and sent their children off to do something else.
To do something else, meaning what they would have done had the parents not won the money.
Yeah, basically.
Mm. Now, could it be that what you found is true for this particular setting, the agrarian southern U.S. in the 19th century, and that for whatever reason, human capital just wasn't so valued and wasn't sought after?
The question is how generic or how much does it generalize to other contexts?
Yeah.
And I think you've hit on the key thing, which is how much was human capital valued and how much was human capital constrained? On the former question, I guess I would say it looks like human capital was valued in the sense that people did send their children to school. People who were literate did make more money. People who had more money did make those investments in their children with a greater, you know, propensity. It just maybe wasn't that the constraint was particularly important, at least to the men who won or lost the lottery. That's a key point, which is that there may have been a lot of money on the table, but they just didn't care because, you know, they didn't care enough about their kids.
But, you know, it gets to a few questions that – a few issues that we're talking about a lot these days in society generally, income inequality and income mobility. The whole idea of the American dream is one could do much better a generation down the road, that our economy affords that opportunity. What you've identified in one setting is where a shock of wealth didn't snowball and turn into a, quote, better life for the generation and the next generation. So I'm curious if you can extrapolate or generalize it all to, you know, the broader U.S. or maybe to the present day from what you've learned. I mean, if we look at a map of the U.S. today that shows where income mobility is high and low, the Deep South, including Georgia's, is pretty much the headquarters of low income mobility. So is it that you've found an example of that, or is it that you found something larger than that, which is that wealth alone is not what turns into greater generational wealth?
I would make two observations. One is that we actually observe pretty strong persistence of outcomes across generations in our sample of lottery losers, right? So think of that as the control, what it would have been absent that. And the numbers that we get from that are actually comparable to modern estimates of persistence of wealth, of persistence of education, literacy, et cetera. And so I don't think that this is a particularly exceptional thing in the sense that, you know, there is mobility, but there's also persistence. And we kind of fall within the range of that. But it still comes back to the question of whether, you know, I think this is true today as it is then, is are the disadvantages that might be present for children that are in poor households, are they present because there's not enough resources, not enough money at the poor household, or is it because there's not enough of something else, right? Maybe the resources have to come from outside the household, be it, say, a good public school. Maybe the resources have to come from the parents, but the parents don't know how to provide it in terms of nurturing, in terms of, you know, reading and communicating ideas to their children, et cetera.
But if we wanted to blow your research up, your research concerns a small place in time and a small geographical place. If we wanted to totally and irresponsibly explode it and try to create some grand generalizations, we should say, well, look, plainly, the viewpoint which holds that giving poor people money, just giving them money, doesn't work because they don't use it to produce what we, the people who give them money, want them to use it for, which is to make their lives and their children's lives appreciably better through getting more education and so on, right? It'd be very easy for, let's say, a politician who believes in that position to read your paper and say, hey, I've got a University of Chicago and a Northwestern economist telling me this is hardcore proof of what I've been saying all along. Is it?
Well, certainly for these, if the politician were contemplating giving wealth to these people in the 1830s, certainly that policy would be that analysis would be right on. I mean, as you said, there are issues about generalizing it, but let's do the wild extrapolation. I think you're right to say this is not evidence that what's missing is money at the household level, right? Because we don't know that it would be spent on these things that we want. That doesn't mean that there's nothing to be done. It's just it doesn't mean that money is the solution, right? Or at least money that gets given to them, to those fathers and mothers.
It's funny, Hoyt, because we actually had a listener write to us recently and say, you know, I really like your show, but God, it's depressing. It's like you take all this good news out there and all these good ideas and good plans and nice intentions and show how, you know, people game the system or they don't work. Now, I disputed this a little bit. I actually think that we're extremely optimistic and kind of hunting always for ideas that do work well. But I'll be honest with you, you've depressed the crap out of me, Hoyt, because you've taken a very basic idea and belief, which is that, you know, poverty is addressable by a very simple intervention, which is giving money to poor people. And you're saying, based on this evidence, that's just not a solid argument, at least when made that narrowly, right?
No, that's right. There may be something you can give to them, but money is not that something, at least in this episode.
All right. Let me ask you this. Not that this is going to be any less depressing, but it might at least be a little bit more entertaining. Have you looked at all at literature on modern lotteries and what happens to people who win them and whether they do a better job of encouraging human capital acquisition among their offspring?
Oh, no. I mean, if you want to be depressed, you should read either the academic literature or, you know, the journalistic accounts of lottery winners because they basically waste it, right, or blow through the money very quickly and oftentimes end up worse than how they started, many of them. Now, it bears mentioning that what distinguishes that group from this one is that it's a very select group of people who go play the lottery every day at the convenience store, right? We economists like to refer to the lottery as a tax on people who don't understand math because, you know, in statistical terms, it's a negative expected value, right? You pay more in than you expect to get back out. And that's different from what we saw in the Georgia lotteries to allocate land because these people, they understood expected value because they paid 12 cents to get basically $100 of expected value, right? So that's a pretty clear decision. But I think it helps us understand to some extent our results in the sense that when you select a particular group of the population and you either give them money or you cajole them to get a little more schooling by bribing them with the cash transfer or cell phone minutes or what have you, you have to ask whether there's some other set of characteristics that they have that makes it hard for them to take advantage of those opportunities. And maybe there's an intervention that helps them better manage those other characteristics, right, that makes it such that that's less of a disadvantage for them. Whereas giving them something, you say, well, this was great for me, it'll be great for you, that's perhaps not the right approach.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.